Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 12:28 on November 6th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. So I thought we'd kick off with 10-year treasuries, because I think that there is probably no more important question out there right now as to what exactly is the Federal Reserve going to do with the prospect of yields rising. Yields have been falling since the peak around 16% back in 1981. And in all that time, the quantity of debt has increased in line with the depression in the yield. So going from just shy of 16% down to 0.8 of 1% is a phenomenal move. It's far more than anyone ever really considered possible. And when we think about that on a log scale chart, then it's really profound just how much of a decline we've had in yields in percentage terms just over the course of the last year. In fact, it is way more considerable in terms of the size of the decline this year than we had, for example, all the way back in 2008. Acceleration is a trend ending. So now the big question is, just how close to the Japanese experience is the USA, or indeed Europe for that matter? We know, for example, that if the 10-year Treasury yield were to go back to about 2%, which is really just a reversion to the mean relative to where the yield is right now, it would represent $100 billion in terms of servicing costs for the debt. That's more than the entire education budget. And that's just unsustainable. There is just no way that the US government can tolerate that kind of move higher in the yield. Well, obviously, then something has to be done about the potential that for the servicing costs of the debt to rise. Well, classically, the answer would be to engage in fiscal discipline and austerity. Well, there is just no way that's going to happen. There is absolutely no tolerance in the wider population to accept lower living standards, higher taxes, lower spending. And while that may yet form part of the response to the lockdowns and the the lockdown-induced recession, it's unlikely to form part of a federal plan in the USA, or indeed anywhere else. In the UK, just this week, we had the Chancellor, the Exchequer, announce the furlough program will be, and that basically means giving people 80% of their paychecks all the way through until March, was greeted simultaneously by the Bank of England supplying as much money as required to fulfill that commitment. Well, this is just another example, as if we needed more, of active modern monetary theory, debt monetization, very similar to exactly what we had in the late 1960s and early 1970s, where the government was willing to spend and the central bank was willing to print as much money as was required. In fact, also in here this week, we had Jay Powell at the Fed standing up and saying that it is absolutely imperative that we get additional fiscal stimulus. In other words, what the Federal Reserve is saying, give us more bonds to buy. Well, that's rather interesting, because we had a significant downward dynamic for the 10-year Treasury yield on Wednesday. Since then, yields have popped up a little and are now right in the region of the trend mean. We can, I think, conclude at this stage that the Federal Reserve is defending the 1% level, and they are willing to do what is necessary in order to stop yields from exceeding that level. Well, that is very similar to what Japan is doing. When we look at the 10-year JGB yield, it has been held below the 0.1% level for years now. And that is a function of Japan's yield control program. So it has been somewhat effective in that they have been able to contain the borrowing costs of the government. Of course, the price for that has been to pump the money full, or pump the economy full of additional new money. And at the time, before the pandemic, Japan was at one at total employment, and in fact was hiring more women, for example, that had classically been outside of the labor pool into the economy. So, and also encouraging more immigrants into the economy as well. And that was all highly stimulative action. So far, it has not resulted in inflation, but inflation is under control in Japan because of low consumption. There's not really a problem with low consumption in the USA. Quite the opposite, in fact. The vast majority of people are willing to spend whatever money they have. And they're even against a background of a lockdown where we've seen savings rates jump higher and consumption decrease. As soon as lockdowns have been eased, then consumption has started to pick back up again. And there's obviously an inverse correlation between lockdowns and consumption. But the big question is the Federal Reserve going to engage in yield curve control? Because they said they weren't going to, but the market is behaving as if they are. And the spread between the 10-year and the 2-year is now at 66 basis points. Historically, when we get these inverted yield curves, then the yield curve does tend to rise in an aggressive manner and go all the way up to exceed 250 basis points. Well, the size of the debt on this occasion is so profound that it is just intolerable for the government to allow that to happen, which means that we are quite likely looking at a period of yield curve control. And it's interesting that following a big pop on the upside in 1994 and 5, then the yield curve went sideways for the next 6, or excuse me, the next 4 years. Then it became inverted sharply again, and then that really was the end of the TMT bubble. Well, one upshot of this provision of additional liquidity and willingness to keep yields under control has been a significant upward dynamic in the technology sector this week. It has rebounded in really a very emphatic fashion, and it is now right back in the region of the upper side of the range that's been forming since the beginning of September. The semiconductors index has also been really quite firm, and the big tech companies, like Google, for example, have also been doing really rather well. Semiconductors at new all-time highs, Google at new all-time highs. I saw a headline today saying that Alphabet's cash alone exceeds the market cap of both IBM and Twitter together. But Apple has also rebounded this week, and that is despite the fact that it has had a really stunning performance already this year. So the technology sector is pricing in the clear potential for low interest rates and low yields to persist for the foreseeable future and for significant additional stimulative measures to be deployed, regardless of what happens in terms of the US presidential election. There is still the clear potential that it's going to be acrimonious and that there will be a recount in a significant number of the swing states. But the market has already moved on from the election, and whatever uncertainty there was has been, in many respects, resolved because we have not had the big blue wave, and that reduces the potential that there is going to be a very significant socialist orientation of the next administration. So, on the one hand, interest rates are down and some of the risks to capitalism have been obviated. So, the solar sector, for example, which had been pulling back ahead of the election, has recouped its entire decline and is now pausing in the region of its peaks. But if we're going to have yield curve control and if we're going to have additional stimulative measures, then the potential for both bonds and equities to rally together means that something has to give. And what is giving is the dollar. And the dollar index was in negative territory in here today. Again, it's back down to the lows from early September, but it has clearly demonstrated resistance around the 94 level. When we then look at this on a longer term basis, it's been ranging for the last 5 years. And so far, this doesn't look like anything other than a distribution in an ongoing period of weakness. The USA is currently the country doing most to devalue its currency. And while that is stoking interest in the stock market in nominal terms, it's not really particularly attractive for international investors. Then when we think about, well, if the dollar is going down, well, then what currencies are going up? Well, it's inevitable that Europe is obviously not going to be happy with the strength of the euro, and as it comes back up towards 120, well, then we're likely to see some additional jawboning measures to try and contain the advance. But Europe is not doing as much today as the USA is doing, and there is still the clear scope for additional stimulative measures from the ECB and from individual European governments, not least because they've engaged in additional lockdowns, and the ECB has been adding additional stimulative measures, and the last update we had was from last week, but it has popped on the upside by about 2 trillion this year. It isn't doing so in an aggressive manner at present. The pace of the advance has moderated considerably over the last month, which is, of course, why the euro has been somewhat steadier. Then I think another very big question from the big cross rates is Japan. Is Japan going to allow the yen to appreciate? Every single time it has strengthened through about 2,200, excuse me, 104 over the course of the last 3 years, it has intervened and pushed it back. Well, there has been a clear bias of strengthening by the yen over the last 5 years, but it really hasn't gone much of anywhere because of the willingness of the BOJ to intervene. The Nikkei index is right at the upper side of its range, and historically, and particularly over the last 5 years, the yen has been at, or every time the yen has weakened, it has led to a nominal price increase in the currency. We're not seeing that today, where the Nikkei has jumped on the upside and the yen has been at a new closing high over the last couple of years. So this is quite different. And the big important chart is to look at the monthly performance of the Nikkei, but we need at least 30 years of data to see just how much of a big first step above the base this range over the last 3 years has been. It's quite likely that if this pop above 24,000 can be sustained and improved upon, well, then we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment. And then the question is, will Japan be willing to allow the yen to appreciate versus the dollar if it is weakening against other currencies? So when we then think about the yen versus the renminbi, or the yen versus the Korean won, well, it really hasn't gone much of anywhere versus the renminbi, and the Korean won is going up faster than the yen right now. So there is the potential, at least, that the Bank of Japan may be under less pressure to try and arrest the advance of the yen. But it's a little too early to reach that conclusion because it's really only just begun to move through 104 versus the dollar. But certainly the action we're seeing on the The Nikkei is positive, but it is not being confirmed yet by the second section index, which still has a downward bias over the last 6 months, although it has been mild relative to the extreme volatility we had earlier this year. But then when we think about other currency indicators like the Asia dollar index, it's clearly now broken the sequence of lower rally highs. It's been trending down for a decade, and it does look increasingly likely that this trend of underperformance is over. Then when we think about the Latin America dollar index, well, we're presented with an even more acute downtrend. It's been trending down in a much more consistent fashion since 2011, and it is really only just beginning to do better with this week's upward dynamic. For a currency index to fall by two-thirds over the course of a decade is really quite profound. And in order to regain the peak from 2011, it would need to rise by two times. Well, that's obviously a promise of a significant potential bull market. One of the reasons why Brazil was so attractive in the period up from the lows in 2003 was because of how successfully the currency rallied. Well, we can see that there have been lengthy periods of time where Latin American currencies have depreciated, and depreciated in a very profound manner. But then we had this phenomenal bull market where the Asia dollar index went up by 50%, but the Brazilian real doubled in that exact same period. And that was one of the most bullish factors behind the Brazilian market, because investors were getting the currency appreciation and they were getting the stock market appreciation on top of it, with the promise of a yield that was competitive as well. And it's when you get that trifecta effect that international investors get excited about emerging markets. So from the low for the real in 2002, it went from 4 to 1 and change. So investors were getting a doubling in their currency trade as well as the appreciation in the stock market. And the Brazilian stock market did phenomenally well in the period from approximately 2002 all the way up to the peak in 2008. Well, if we then just simply look at that on a constant currency basis, well, we then get a much closer idea of just how profound the bull market was from 2003 to 2008 and the subsequent bear market as well. Because when we look at it in nominal terms, it looks like the Brazilian market did really very well in the period from 2016 onwards. And it did. It went from 10 to 30,000 in a US dollar basis, and then gave it all up this year. So it's really only just beginning to steady from the perspective of an international investor. And that's equally true of lots of different emerging markets. The Indian market has been underperforming for the last couple of years, but it is now back in the region of its peaks in US dollar terms, and that is now right in the region of the peak from 2007 as well. So there has been a 12-year period of time where international investors haven't been particularly well rewarded for investing in India. They're just about back to the levels that they were in 2007, so 13 years ago. But now there is the scope for additional upside. When we then think about the Indonesian market, it's a very similar story. The clear message this week was that international investors woke up to the potential that emerging markets are not only cheap, but have a real potential to outperform in a big way when currency moves in their favor. So the Indonesian market did fantastically well in the period from 2002 up to its peak in 2007, and then it was also doing even better in the period up from 2008 all the way through to the peak in 2012, which was when the currency started underperforming, and that sucked money out of the market. So now we're at a point where the currency is beginning to strengthen again. It was up in a dynamic manner in here this week. It has unwound all of the panicky decline in March, and we're seeing that this willingness of global currencies to appreciate, or perhaps the willingness of governments all over the world to allow their currencies to appreciate versus the dollar, is because China is allowing the renminbi to appreciate, and the renminbi has been accelerating lower, or excuse me, has higher with the dollar falling. That really takes a lot of the pressure off of anywhere that is trading with China. So it's allowing them to allow their currencies to appreciate in line with China. There is, then we can just remember exactly what it means to trade currencies. There are two adages that David coined. The first was that no country wants a strong currency, but some need a weaker currency more than others. Well, right now, the USA needs a weaker currency. They are still battling the coronavirus. There is a lot of social unrest, and they need a weaker currency, and they're getting it. Well, one of the most clearly defined characteristics of the pandemic and the coronavirus is that it most acutely affects elderly people, and emerging markets generally have fewer of those, so they are likely to come out of the pandemic in a much more robust fashion. They may also be at less risk of abandoning social distancing and just allowing herd immunity to emerge, because younger people tend to be much less badly affected by the virus in the first place. And against that background, they don't need the weakness of their currency quite as much as other countries do. I think it is much more relevant to look at cross rates with the Asia dollar index, or the Latin America dollar index, or the Chinese renminbi, than it does against the euro dollar rate or the yen dollar rate, because those currencies are competing for the title of the most acutely affected by the pandemic. Whereas the other big adage that David had was that it was happiness in the currency markets is having the trend and the central bank on your side. Well, the trends that are emerging are very much in favor of emerging market currencies, and the central bank is also on your side, and the yield differential has been certainly bolstered. There is the clear scope, and at least this is what the bond market appears to be suggesting, that China will be the first country to raise interest rates, and the 10-year yield is at 3.2%. Then when we think about their domestic stock market, one of the primary reasons why there has been a willingness to support the stock market in China over the last 6 months has been because of the introduction of the security measures in Hong Kong, because of the clear damage that did to the international reputation of the region. There had to be a clear effort to try and pour money into the financial system in order to create confidence. Well, that whole process got another setback this week when they cancelled the Ant Financial IPO. And against that background, obviously a lot of people are questioning what the trend of governance is and what faith one might have in, or can have in, the equity markets when just by a an abrupt decision, an IPO can be cancelled. Could they subsequently do the same thing to a listed company? We certainly saw something akin to this with measures that were taken against Tencent about 2 years ago when they simply banned computer games, just again by writ. So right now the stock market is firming, and from a foreign investor's perspective, it's broken out. This is the local currency, and when we look at it in US dollars, it has clearly broken out. So when you have the yield and the currency and the trend on your side, it's going to attract additional investors. The yield on the CSI 300 is 1.8%. And the yield on the S&P 500 is 1.71%. But here, you may have the trend on your side, but you don't have the currency. So it's likely to be beneficial for domestic investors. And it is also likely to pad the earnings of the big international companies. I think it's about 40% of earnings in the S&P 500 come from overseas. Well, those earnings are immediately going to become more valuable. This whole range looks like a consolidation in the region of the previous peak. There's plenty of evidence to support the view that support has been found in the region of the trend mean, and that there is scope for additional upside. But we no longer have the currency on our side. That is helping emerging markets to play catch up. I thought this was a particularly interesting graphic from about 2 months ago, and it shows the clear correlation between emerging markets and gold. Well, gold had already clearly broken out, and the catalyst that was required in order to really start to get interest going in emerging markets again was the currency. Well, gold popped on the upside yesterday, and it held on to the advance today. That is at least confirming that we are back in a demand-dominated environment, and that support, at least in the near term, has been found in the region of $1,900, or perhaps more accurately, $1,850. Gold is prone to big moves, but it's also prone to periods of ranging. But we're in a period now where we are clearly seeing that financial repression is a very real possibility. And that is creating an incentive for investors all over the world to look for a hedge, or to look for an escape route, and to simply get out of the currencies where the greatest risk of financial repression is represented. So certainly gold does represent one of those avenues, and that's a good reason for why it should be doing better. And there is the clear scope that it is going to be one of the places where people are attracted to. Then we can think about the gold miners. They're extremely profitable at $1,900. But investors don't look at profitability. What they want to see is growth, and particularly growth in profits. So as soon as gold started to move higher, we've seen a significant rebound for the gold miners ETF, and this time from the region of the trend mean. This has been a 3 to 4 month period of consolidation, and it looks like it is increasingly approaching the end of that consolidation, and that we are now angling for the next significant breakout. One of the reasons that investors like gold is because it is prone to extreme volatility on the upside. Of course, nobody likes it when it pulls back in a violent manner, but unfortunately that does go with the territory. And when we know that that is a feature of the market, well, it really just behooves us to have orders way below where prevailing prices are, because they will occasionally be hit. Well, gold shares now start to perform. This is also a time when high beta plays on gold will become more attractive. So silver prices have been forming now their first step above the base formation and firmed additionally yesterday and followed through on the upside in here today. So this is rather positive action over the balance of the week, and it is confirming at least near-term support around the $22 level. Platinum prices have been lagging and they continue to lag, but they are at least in the region of the psychological $900 area. It's going to have to sustain a move above 1,000 in order to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. The other high beta way of playing gold is to look at the junior miners. They also look like they're putting in a first step above the base in a very similar manner to what silver is doing, which would also be considered a high beta play on gold. Then when we think about the explorers, well, they are even more junior than the junior miners, and they haven't quite yet been able to complete the base formation. So what we also have evidence of here is that there is a sequence order in the appetite for risk among people that are looking for a hedge against the depreciation of the dollar. We had the early movers come into the market in 2019. Then we've had people become excited about gold, and then we had the really big decline following the panic around the lockdowns. Well, now with the clear potential for financial repression, we're starting to see interest in the gold sector picking up again. And it does look increasingly likely that people are going to become much more excited about gold. But there is also a demographic issue, because it's generally older people tend to be interested in gold because they feel more comfortable with a physical asset. And having a real asset in an environment where there is a very significant push towards towards money printing and financial repression obviously makes sense. But younger people who've grown up with the internet and with assets and value being online are more comfortable with Bitcoin. And it's generally younger people tend to be supporting this market. So prices got up towards $16,000 in here today. They're up approximately 60% over the course of the last 10 weeks. And it really is that percentage move tends to really animate investors, because one of the most clearly defined characteristics of the big bull market that we've had in cryptocurrencies over the last decade has been its ability to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. It did that following the big decline in 2014 and 15, and it did it again following the very significant decline after the acceleration in 2017. Well, it found support again in the region of the 1,000-day moving average earlier this year, around 4,000. It's up nearly four times since then. But again, it isn't so much about the size of the gains, which are extraordinarily intimidating, but rather the consistency of the trend overall, because it tends to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average when it is pulling back, and it is liable to have these lengthy consolidations, which can last up to 3 years. And we've just had another one. So the price now is within striking distance of the 20,000 level. At the current rate of advance, it could be there next week. But what the big bulls of the cryptocurrency market are looking for is a significant pop on the upside and a perhaps 2 year run to 100,000 or even 200,000. That would be a copycat move to what we saw in 2016 and 17. Back in 2017, it pulled in retail investors from all over the world. One of the big significant factors that occurred was that a lot of college-age kids went home after, during the Thanksgiving break, convinced their parents that this was a big new bull market, and a wad of new money came into the market between November and the end of the year. And that represented the end of that particular portion of the bull market. What we are now starting to see is much more interest from institutional investors, and it is completely linked to this fear of financial repression. Because when family offices have got assets very much tied into the bond markets and tied into assets that are domestically oriented, then they obviously need to try and think about diversifying. And then when they look around the world, it's a question of governance. Well, really, the cryptocurrency markets are the antithesis of fears about governance. Their whole modus operandi is to circumvent concerns about governance, and this whole decentralization mantra is what they're predicated on. There's obviously the potential here that cryptocurrencies are going to be one of the bigger beneficiaries of the financial repression theme, and the smaller ones are just beginning to start to move. I also tend to think of Ethereum as being more like silver is to gold. It's poor man's Bitcoin. And it then also tends to do well in the acceleration phase. So it's quite likely that Bitcoin is going to pull Ethereum higher. And it will likely do that in a sequential manner with the other significant altcoins, and then with the much less significant altcoins after that. But we are certainly seeing much more interest coming through and into the cryptocurrency space because of the devaluation of the dollar and because of this financial repression theme overall. But then we also have the fact that commodity prices generally are also doing better, and the continuous commodity index looks almost exactly like the Asia dollar index. It peaked in 2011 and it did nothing but decline until really quite recently, but it is now starting to firm up. We're also seeing that the aluminium sector is also doing better, and it has rebounded really quite emphatically since the low in March. But again, these prices are really extremely depressed relative to where they were trading a decade ago. The BlackRock World Mining ETF, or excuse me, Trust, is firming within the range that's been going on now for the last 5 months. It's right in the region of the upper side of its base formation. There is obviously the potential that it is going to do better from here as well. It's also trading at a discount of about just less than 8%. And that is, if we just look at more history, then unfortunately that seems to be having difficulty coming up. When we think about what that means in terms of what's regular, there have been occasions when it has gone significantly wider or significantly tighter, but the reality is it's pretty normal for the trust to trade at about an 8% discount. So it doesn't represent value on that basis. But there is the potential that we're going to see significant advances in the demand for commodities, because every government in the world is going to be interested in some kind of reflation theme next year. They are still combating the pandemic. I've been commenting on the pandemic less because I think we are past the worst of the hysteria. A lot of the hysteria was very much tied into the US presidential election. In many respects, the presidential election was a referendum on the need for social distancing and lockdowns. And about half of people said they're not interested in that anymore. They're more interested in the economy. And everybody wants to get back to work. There are millions of people who have seen their livelihoods destroyed, and life savings have gone up in smoke. That's particularly true for small business owners. Well, there will have to be efforts made to try and get as many people back to work as possible. That means significant additional stimulus, and infrastructure development is one of the number one ways to get people back to work. There is a need for commodities, for plant and machinery, for workers, but then also for planners, for people to figure out logistics, trucking. All of these types of endeavors will be boosted by infrastructure development. And that is going to be equally true of just about everywhere. It's also occurring at a time where companies are increasingly willing to consider reshoring, offshoring, or the potential for deglobalization. And that represents a significant cost, but also it represents continued demand for commodities. Well, the big question then is, what is going to happen in terms of the oil price? Because it was in negative territory today, but it was up for most of the week and rallied rather impressively off its lows. It needs to push through and above the highs posted in October, which would be about $44. If it can do that, well, then we're back in a demand-dominated environment. But the problem for oil is that it has got significant competition. It's not really the same as copper. When we think about copper, it benefits from infrastructure development, but it's also in a net beneficiary as well from the rollout of electric vehicles. There are multiple pounds of copper required in every electric vehicle. The faster that the sector grows, the more demand it will take up from the global copper market. But that's not true of oil. And the big question then for the oil price is not so much about demand growth, but more about supply destruction. There is a significant rationalization underway for the energy sector overall. When we think about the high-yield energy spreads, they surged higher to over 200 basis, excuse me, to 20% in early this year, which is 2,000 basis points. Since then, that spread has come straight back down again, and not least because of the actions of the Federal Reserve to step in and start buying corporate bonds. That's been a factor in the slow pace of rationalization, but just because the companies haven't quite gone bust yet does not mean that they can make money. Well, eventually we're going to see a resumption of economic activity. Then that will help to revitalize the outlook for energy. But there is an awful lot of additional supply that is available that could be brought to bear, and that is likely to contain the outlook for significant additional upside. I think that a lot of that has probably been priced into some of these energy company shares. They have at least broken sequences of lower rally highs. So it's beginning to suggest that there is at least some room for additional upside. But then they have the additional obstacle of impending costs being imposed upon their businesses because of the rising cost of carbon credits. Carbon credits rebounded in here this week as well, right in line with commodities. And since this is politically oriented, it's quite likely that the cost of carbon credits will continue to rise indefinitely in order to support the continued evolution of the renewable energy transformation. Personally, I'm not yet convinced about the sustainability of renewables if it was simply about profits. But there is a good reason why both China and Europe have adopted a carbon neutral strategy by 2050. The USA is energy independent, and that is a massive geopolitical advantage. So if China or Europe wants to effectively compete with the USA, they also need to achieve energy independence. And neither is a significant producer of oil or gas, which really means that they have got a monumental task in front of them to try and achieve energy independence. And their answer to that particular riddle has been to invest in renewables. Well, to the extent that there is a massive rollout of solar and wind, then the conclusion is that it will eventually contribute to a green hydrogen market. Well, right now, natural gas is the primary feedstock for hydrogen, and that is likely to remain the case for at least the next 5 or 6 years. But there is a great deal of capital being devoted to building out hydrogen facilities, and that is a new bull market. The companies in it are really quite small, and they have got massive scope to appreciate from here. It represents probably the same kind of potential that shale oil and gas represented in 2006 and 7. We are that early in the cycle in terms of the evolution of hydrogen, and that is quite likely to be a generational phenomenon. So oil is likely to remain a significant portion of the global economy for the foreseeable future, as in the next 5 years. But hydrogen only needs to double or quadruple in the next decade for some of these shares to go from just millions to billions in terms of their market caps. As we look further out into the future, we are rapidly coming to a point where the quantity of debt outstanding is going to represent a problem. People are really only beginning to hedge their exposure to that debt today, but eventually it's going to have to come to a head. And when that happens, well, it's usually because there is a war, or because there is a very significant revaluation of currencies. Historically, that has either been that there have been a massive war, and then people had to sit down and figure out what the next monetary global environment was going to be. And the lesser examples of that kind of extreme are multilateral intervention. So that's also potential. Now, we're only just beginning to see the dollar declining. It could go down for at least another 2 or 3 years before any prospect of multilateral intervention to support it were really considered. But it does look increasingly likely that with the mere threat of financial repression, in fact, I think that the last time that financial repression was really considered relevant was back in 2002 and 2003. That was the beginning of the commodity and emerging markets bull market, and I think it is going to be exactly the same on this occasion. It represents the clear opportunity from a longer-term international investors' perspective to favor emerging markets today over the developed markets because they have the currency, the yield, and the trend on their sides. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.